who are coming in.
We have
in
10 seconds, Valerie. Large,
when we have a lot of a number of people coming into the border, they will cross to border counties or border cities, and the city manager then said that it would at least give them some reprieve, some financial reprieve, which they have seen and are now re-experiencing again.
Dusan, I want to give you the last word, and we only have another 10 seconds. You've been there for 2 years. What gives you hope?
I'm a Christian. I'm a real faithful Christian. I preach the gospel, the Jesus Christ, and I try to support the motto of everybody over here. And my faith tell me we can make it to the United States, and we pray a lot to the president can be changed. So really we have that goal made it, and now we have the Joe Biden administration, and I believe it. He was over here in the beginning of this game.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue to cover this story. Of course, Dusan, asylum seeker, and as well as Valerie Gonzalez, I thank you both for being with us, and Chloe Rastetter. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Bluegrass lovers, tune in Saturday, March 13th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for a very special quarantine version of the Bluegrass Marathon from your friends at Music from the True Vine.
This year's marathon will feature homespun, socially distanced recordings from Jack Straw,
Left Coast Country,
John Cale and Annie Stanenitz,
Caleb Clowder and Reeve Wilms,
Doug Sammons and Jeff Smith,
Farmstrong,
and many, many more.
Don't miss this unique radio event to catch up with your friends and neighbors, playing music, and sharing stories from the lockdown.
Again, tune in to KBOO Saturday, March 13th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for the Bluegrass Marathon.
Don't miss it.
Why do you love KBOO? Tell us what you most love about KBOO Community Radio, and we will use it on air during our next membership drive. Record a one-minute testimonial using the KBOO mobile app, or use a voice recording app on your phone and email it to info@kboo.org. That's info@kboo.org. Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m., or it's 8:01 a.m. It's Wednesday. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I just want to wish Buffy St. Marie, who you just heard a snippet of, a happy birthday. She just turned 80 years old on February 20th, just a few days ago. So let's all sing happy birthday. Well, maybe not. Anyway, I love Buffy St. Marie, and I hope you do too. If you haven't really checked her out, She's been making music for 6 decades at least. Still going strong. Okay, with that, I am going to talk about Texas and beyond. Climate change, corporate control of energy production, deregulation, frack gas, public utility commissions, and more, with Mitch Jones, who is the policy director of Food and Water Watch. And they recently released a statement on the Texas power debacle, which I'm going to start off reading a little bit, if that's okay with you, Mitch. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, by all means.
The climate change supercharged deep freeze covering Texas has left millions without power and water. The failure of the energy system is a direct result of corporate deregulation and an over-reliance on fracked gas, while right-wing media outlets and politicians make wildly false claims about the failure of wind power. The whole disaster is yet another clear sign we need bold government action to transform our energy system. The Texas energy system relies primarily on fracked gas, a source that greatly contributes to climate change, in addition to the litany of public health and environmental impacts linked to the fracking process. The failure of Texas's gas-powered system due to freezing temperatures shows frack gas to be an unreliable energy source. The other culprit is the structure of the Texas power system itself, the grid primarily operated by ERCOT, Electric Reliability Council of Texas, is mostly cut off from the rest of the country. In the late 1990s, companies like Enron were pushing energy deregulation across the country, most notably in states like California and Texas. The free market disaster in California led to wild price swings, market manipulation, and widespread blackouts in 2000-2001. In Texas, critics of deregulation point out that the promised cost savings have never arrived, and there is little incentive for companies to invest in the kind of weatherization and maintenance that would have prevented some of the problems that have left millions without power. And in a deregulated market faced with a supply shortage, prices have skyrocketed. The power and water crisis in Texas is a result of climate change, fracking, deregulation, and poorly maintained water and power infrastructure. It's Exhibit A on why we need a Green New Deal that invests in building renewable energy with battery storage, modernizes our power system, rebuilds our water infrastructure, and regulates these systems in the public interest. This should be a massive wake-up call that oil and gas barons shouldn't be driving decisions on our energy needs. We need publicly owned utilities that are operated for the benefit of the people and the planet, not corporate profits. Okay, well, we can just hang up now. I've already said everything you were going to say.
I couldn't say it better myself, Paul.
And that was actually a press release that you released. No, I just kind of wanted to get out there quick and dirty and just sort of set the stage, because we're going to be going much deeper into it, into all the different, because there's a lot to unpack. I hear that there's still millions of people without water because I think, as some of us know, have had this experience after a big thaw from freeze, more pipes can tend to break. So there's going to be ongoing problems with that. But let me just, first of all, let you talk a little bit about yourself and your organization. I've had people from Food and Water Watch on a number of times. People may remember quite a few years ago, there was a big issue about Nestle and a proposed water bottling plant in the Columbia River Gorge, which never ended up getting built, partially thanks to your organization and the efforts of many people. And so, Food and Water Watch, what is it? How long has it been around, and what do you do?
Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you for having me on, joining your listeners this morning in Portland. So Food and Water Watch has been around for, we're in our 16th year now, and we fight to ensure that there is safe and affordable food and water for everyone, with a focus on taking on the industrialized food system, promoting proper funding and regulation for water utilities, and, you know, in recent years especially, taking on the fossil fuel industry, taking on fracking, and fighting to make sure that we get the right policies in place to combat the ever worsening climate crisis that we're all living through, because we realize that until we tackle climate change, we're not going to be able to reform the food and water systems in a way that will provide safe and affordable food and water for everyone. So, you know, that's our mission. That's what we've been working on. And, you know, I remember the fight against the Nestle bottled watering plant out in Oregon. We worked on that for years with many great activists on the ground there. And, you know, it was really a great win when that plant, the plans for that plant were withdrawn.
And we also, another proposed bottling plant, I can't remember if it was Nestle, another one, was further up on the Washington side of the gorge, got defeated. A number of plans for plants in Washington State have come to naught. So along with the many victories we've had on fossil fuel export facilities, the Pacific Northwest is holding the line on the ridiculous overproduction of bottled water, which is an ironic thing. I'd like to actually maybe talk about that, because we see with all these massive disasters that because the infrastructures are so heavily impacted, especially the water infrastructure from hurricanes, even, you know, wildfires, the whole distribution system breaks down, that there's this huge increased reliance on bottled water, which is just one of the many strange ironies of the time we're in.
Yeah, you know, the ironies compound upon themselves these days, don't they? It's a weird occurrence when the corporations that are engaged in extractive practices, whether it's, you know, drilling for oil and gas, or you know, extracting water for bottling, then somehow try to reap the rewards on the disasters that follow from those practices. You know, the natural disasters, which are only growing stronger and more frequent, then allow them, just like happened in Texas last week, to reap either actual real dollar profits, or in the case of the bottled water being supplied to victims of major storms, PR victories for the companies that then are seen being, you know, good Samaritans or whatever you want to call them, by donating bottled water, when in fact, you know, what they've been doing is extracting a public resource that really belongs to all of us and needs to be have stewardship by the people to be protected for our use, and, you know, needs to be defended by having proper investments made in the infrastructure to make sure that they can withstand the ever-increasing violent weather patterns and wildfires that we're seeing.
Yeah, no, I'm glad I actually brought that up, because it's, you know, it's almost the bottled water almost becomes a substitute for investments in infrastructure. And then you look at the ridiculously low how they virtually give away water in so many places around the United States, and no doubt around the world, that they allow these big, huge corporations, multi-billion-dollar corporations, to extract water from our very precious underwater reservoirs, underwater sources, at pennies on the gallon, and then allow, as you're saying, the actual infrastructure, which could provide good, safe drinking water and water for all the other uses for the people. It's just a travesty.
It really is. And, you know, I'm going to give you a little scoop here, Paul, and hopefully my communications people don't call me up after this and yell at me. But actually, tomorrow, legislation is being introduced in Congress that would fully fund our water and wastewater utilities across the country to the tune of $35 billion a year. It's called the Water Act. It's been introduced in the past, but it's being introduced again in this Congress tomorrow. It's led by Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence of Michigan, and Congressman Ro Khanna of California, and then in the Senate, it's led by Senator Bernie Sanders. And it's a really vital piece of legislation that would, really address the water crisis that we face in this country, from crumbling infrastructure, rising costs. You know, people can't afford to pay their water bills. They get their water shut off. In some instances, they have their homes taken away from them because they can't pay their water bills. There's a real crisis. You know, we've seen it obviously most bluntly in places like Flint. But there's a rural water crisis where water is being contaminated by PFAS and other forever chemicals. And, you know, this legislation is being introduced tomorrow. It would really go a long way to solving the water crisis in this country.
Uh-huh. Well, let me just give out the number, 503-231-8187. I was about to give my home phone number, which wouldn't have worked. Especially since I'm occupying it right now. 503-231-8187. That's the number to reach Sonia, who's operating the board at KABU. I am calling from my home phone, and I'm talking with Mitch Jones, the policy director of the Food and Water Watch, and we're talking. Well, let's just dive into Texas, since that's the main thing. But of course, we're gonna, this isn't. Texas is really the poster child for how not to prepare for disasters, how not to deal with disasters when they arise, how not to contribute to climate change disasters and all that. But of course, we can talk about the wildfires in Oregon. You know, the municipalities, still some municipalities still don't have water because of the devastation that the wildfires did. The town of Detroit, down southeast of here, where I am speaking, is still, I believe, without their municipal water system that was just totally devastated by the wildfires, and that's something that occurs elsewhere. And, of course, here in Portland, we have our Bull Run watershed, which for now is still managed pretty decently, but is also subject to the possibility of catastrophic wildfires. So, anyway, there's many different intersecting issues that also touch us here in the Pacific Northwest. But, okay, so ERCOT, what is ERCOT, and what do they have to do with what happened in Texas?
Well, ERCOT is the organization that is in charge of running the grid, the electric grid in Texas. The electric grid is a complicated thing, and Texas is the only state in the lower 48 states that has its own grid, its own interconnection that is largely separated from the rest of the country. So there's an eastern connection in which most of the eastern states are connected to one another. There's a western connection in which most of the western states are connected. There's a couple of tie-ins between the two. And then there's Texas, which, for the most part, there are some regions in Texas which are not part of ERCOT, but for the most part, Texas is on its own. It's managed by ERCOT, and they're the entity that's responsible for assuring that there is an adequate amount of electricity on the grid at all times to meet demand. And last week, they failed miserably.
And they are overseen by actually a public utility district with commissioners, which sounds like a good thing. And there are good public utility districts that are actually run in the interests of the people, but they're also not so good ones. I noticed we have a caller, John, on the line, but hold on, John, just a second. Why don't you talk a little bit about the public utility districts and how ERCOT has been managed?
Yeah, so ERCOT is an entity with appointed commissioners, all of whom resigned this morning. And oddly, they all lived out of state. So although Texas has its own grid because they wanted to avoid being regulated by federal regulators, that is the reason why they have their own grid, is they didn't want to be regulated by federal regulation. For some reason, all of their commissioners lived out of state. They all resigned this morning. the Public Utility Commission in Texas is the appointed governmental body that has oversight over ERCOT. Those members are appointed by the governor, and therefore have a little more, in some respects, public accountability, yet weirdly, none of them have resigned. And the governor hasn't called on them to resign. So in some respects, yes, ERCOT has to shoulder a lot of blame, but they're also being scapegoated by the elected officials and the appointed government officials who are trying to deflect blame from them, from themselves, and put them on to ERCOT. We should also mention that there were a lot of failures with the natural gas infrastructure in Texas last week, and that's overseen by the Texas Railroad Commission, which is actually a statewide elected body in Texas. They had a meeting, I believe, again, it was this morning, and they didn't even really touch on the great failures that they also had last week during the storm.
Yes, I just started to read a little bit into the history of public utility commissions. Apparently, railroad mm-hmm. commissions were the first regulatory, I guess railroads were considered a utility. So they were actually mm-hmm. the beginning of quote, utility regulation in the United States. Before we go deeper into that, let's just hear what John has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air, John.
Good morning. Just before your show, they announced they wanted people to call in and give what they're thankful for KBOO over. And then your show came on with Buffy St. Marie, so I'm going to thank you, Paul, for introducing me to you and KBOO, not just you, introducing me to fantastic music of all sources, but especially Native American. I was moved to tears this morning when I heard the Interior Secretary, a Native American woman, I forget her name now, I'm not good with names.
Deb Haaland.
Yeah, giving her opening statement. It was just fantastic to hear such an intelligent woman. First Native American cabinet member, and I think in the history of this country, as far as I know.
If she gets approved, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's sure hope so, because we need some intelligence in this administration. I mean, well, we'll obviously have an improvement, but we need it urgently. But I want to thank you and KBOO for introducing me to so many good speakers and the musicians over the years. And as far as public utilities, I live outside of Battleground, and I used to get wood chips from they'd come along and clean up trees that were threatening the power lines, and there'd be a crew of like six or eight people working on that with chainsaws and a big chipping machine, and they'd give the chips to whoever was in the close by, and we'd get loads of chips, and I was using it to make compost and support the trees I'm growing. And then they quit doing that, and they replaced it all with this horrible shredding machine that just comes through and can reach in 17 feet, I measured it, from the edge of the road and shred everything in sight. I don't live on a designated scenic road.
Well, John, it's actually a very interesting story, but it'd probably be good if we keep to the main topic, which is the electrical utilities and their impact on us and climate change and all that.
All right. Well, what I was trying to get at is we have power outages all the time now because, they're not doing the proper maintenance, but they are really fast at getting the power back on. Well, why not, we should have had buried power lines long ago, and it's just stupid the way they do everything in this country. Anyway.
Okay, well, that's a buried power lines. That's I've heard people talk about that, and I guess that's one thing that definitely is should be a subject for discussion. Thanks for calling in, John. 503-231-8187 is the number to get your comment or question in to my guest, Mitch Jones. What about buried power lines? That's a component. Is that something that you see as an important subject?
Yeah, I do. I think that especially in places that are susceptible to wildfires, as you've all been experiencing in the Northwest, burying the power lines makes a lot of sense. Of course, it's not only in wildfires where things like that happen. You know, you have an ice storm, they can snap power lines, snap trees that then fall over and knock out power lines. So in many respects, in terms of resilience of the system, having the lines underground does avoid the impacts of things like wildfires and ice storms. And, you know, there's been a proposal in the Midwest to run high power lines from wind farms to, you know, more urban areas where the electricity is needed by burying them alongside railroad tracks, essentially, you know, using the existing right-of-way so that you're not putting up new lines going through, you know, people's farms and property. And it, this strikes me as a really good common sense way to get a more reliable grid built so that we see fewer power outages due to the worsening storms that come along with climate change.
Of course, you could always put them in the center strips on freeways, and then on top of them build rail lines, or just get rid of the freeways and put in rail lines. But anyway, we don't want to get too far afield here. But so let's get back to the public utility commissions and the whole deregulatory trend. You talk, you know, in your statement, you talked about Enron in the 80s, 90s, and that debacle, which they actually tried to come here and take over PGE. Actually, I think they, I can't remember that history, but yeah. And so public utility commissions, as I said, can be a good thing if they're actually run democratically and if there's people who really understand the issues, who are in charge of them and all that. But they just, if they're rubber stamped, as you said, by Texas politicians who are totally in the pocket of the oil and gas industry, it seems like the results are predictable. And then, of course, there's the, you know, look at North Dakota, South Dakota, where they had to approve the right-of-way of the of pipelines, and there they kind of rubber stamped them too. So talk about public utility commissions more.
Well, in general, it's not just the Public Utility Commission, it's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, which also oversees a lot, especially with those interstate pipelines, like you were talking about in North and South Dakota, but not only there. You know, they do act largely and have acted largely as a rubber stamp for the oil and gas industry. It's part of the whole notion of regulatory capture, where the industries are able to get the regulators on their side. And, you know, part of that is because of the phenomenon of the revolving door between public service and, you know, corporate employment. So as people, you know, leave these regulatory jobs, where do they go? Well, they go to the corporations that they had just been overseeing. And then when a new administration comes in and needs to appoint regulators, where do they go? Well, they go to those corporations and appoint people who have worked there. And it's an ongoing problem where our regulatory structure gets captured by the very interests that they are supposed to be overseeing. It doesn't only happen, obviously, in the energy sector. It happens elsewhere as well. But the impacts in the energy sector are clearly severe, as we're seeing, you know, in Texas this past week, but also with, you know, these pipelines that are being built through, you know, indigenous land into the Dakotas, through people's you know, farmland and woodlands in other states without their, you know, express permission, because the regulators are rubber stamping what the oil and gas industry and the electric utilities are asking of them. You know, and the other problem in Texas, which you've alluded to, is that the market is deregulated. It at the behest of Enron and under George W. Bush, Texas deregulated its electricity market, and that has led to a whole range of problems. There was just a report in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, this morning about the failure of deregulation in Texas, saying that since 2004, when full deregulation was fully in line in Texas, bills have been $28 billion higher than they would have been if the electric sector had remained regulated. You know, that's a huge cost to the people of Texas. And weirdly, those costs aren't then being invested to make the system more resilient. You know, they're being siphoned off into profits. And so we have these systems where these corporations have captured the regulators that oversee them. They've become deregulated by the politicians whose campaigns they've funded. They're reaping huge profits, and the rest of us are made to suffer because the investment and oversight that we need made in these public systems isn't happening.
And of course, you know, to again tie it to, you know, it's not just Texas, although Texas does seem to be kind of a worst case scenario, in addition to the fact that, you know, the freakishness of that weather event, which, if one actually understands the dynamics of climate change, is not so freakish because that's the nature of the warm, accelerated warming in the Arctic, which is throwing off the jet stream, which is throwing this polar vortex into weirder and weirder and more southern arcs, which is what happened. But the fact that, you know, it did happen in a place that's not used to such intense and prolonged cold was a huge factor. But of course, they also had a similar event 10 years ago, and so the writing right. was already on the wall. So again, there's many things, but I was going to talk about, you know, the PGE in California that, for years they've been trying to get them to, maintain their power lines that, are, susceptible to having, things fall on them and then creating an arc and sparks and setting forest fires, which they actually mm-hmm. ended up shelling out millions of dollars in fines on, which leads to this deeper question again of just, are private corporations capable of handling what's coming down on us, which is you give a resounding no in your statement. But before, just keep that all in mind, but we have had a caller waiting online for a little while at 503-231-8187. We're halfway through. We got Harry. What do you got to say?
Ah, greetings, and thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'd like to talk about the Texas power grid. Well, the Texas power grid is actually a third world power grid. Their issues, a lot of the regulatory stuff was not. Here's a good example of what they're trying to hide. The two nuclear power plants in Texas shut down. Well, why did nuclear power plants shut down? Or they started back up? The only thing I could think of is they use power to do the lights and everything else. And like, if it's does it has natural gas or electricity going to these nuclear power plants? But they were shut down. And why? Because they weren't weatherized either. Well, if you look at the nuclear power plants in Maine and New York and, you know, the Three Mile Island, they go through storms and they never shut down. And so this is something that I think the federal government has to step in and saying, and maybe even take over the grid, because this is dangerous. We don't know. Example, a big thing about nuclear power plants now is the reactor of it. They were saying that the reactor the walls get brittle, and so and after it freezing like this and then thawing up again, that can't be good for it. So I think that's what they need to investigate, is these nuclear power plants in Texas. They're dual ones. They have two reactors, which means they probably have two cooling towers. And like problems with their nuclear power plants is dangerous.
Well, there's lots of other problems with nuclear power plants, of course. But thank you, Harry. Go ahead, Mitch. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it is striking that they did have to take some of the nuclear power in Texas offline. And I'll just point out that Food and Water Watch is opposed to nuclear power and has called for it to be shut down. I've heard different stories about why they had to shut down the plant that they did in Texas. One is that some of the instruments froze, and then the other was that there was actually a problem with freezing of water in the cooling tanks. So I'm not sure which one is the accurate account of what happened, but it does go back to what Harry said, and it's that they're not winterized. And that is true of the natural gas plants that shut down, the nuclear plants that shut down, and, you know, frankly, the wind turbines that had problems, is that because there's no real regulation of the electric system in Texas, and because after the event in 2011, which you referenced a minute ago, Paul, and also they came close to losing power again in a winter storm in 2014. So this is really the third event in 10 years, at which point it's no longer unusual. They didn't winterize because it's cheaper not to, and therefore you have higher profits. So that has been a problem, but it does go back to the fact that you don't have proper regulation and you're allowing for-profit companies to make these decisions basically for themselves. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, if not higher, those for-profit companies are going to choose profits over anything that resembles the public good. And that's why we have called so strongly for public ownership of not only electric utilities, but also of the fossil fuel companies that we know we're going to have to ramp down quickly over the next decade or so in order to stop extracting and burning fossil fuels, stop driving climate change, stop making these storms and quote-unquote unusual weather patterns more frequent. It's got to be managed for the public good, and it cannot be left up to people who are operating on the profit motive.
There's so much to go with that. I remember when the BP disaster in the Gulf happened, mm-hmm. Right around the same time as the Fukushima disaster and the Big Branch mine disaster in West Virginia. Anyway, it was these things just seem to be happening more and more. But you know, I was wondering who's going to be calling on just seize BP's assets. I mean, they're clearly not going to be able to do anywhere near clean up. The idea of cleaning up the Gulf or something like that is kind of a ridiculous concept to begin with, but clearly they're not going to be able to devote the resources. You're going to have to fight with them tooth and nail for every penny. So, the idea of, I guess that kind of goes to, the greatest fear. You know, of course, they would hate you and me for even having this conversation, so we don't care. But, the right-wingers calling anything communist that even smacks slightly of what you're hinting at, but I was thinking of the actual seizure, the nationalization of industries mm-hmm. by Allende's government or whatever. But yeah, I mean, but even after the fact, the idea of seizing a corporation's assets to adequately deal with the total disaster they've created. Anyway, we're going far afield here, but I'd like to continue this and also get into the idea of decentralization of power production versus deregulation. But we do have another caller at 503-231-8187. We only have about 20 minutes left, so you better get your call in soon, 503-231-8187. But Edie is up on the stack. Go ahead, Edie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was going to say some of the things that you then both host and guest said, so thank you so much. What I think we need to do is to decentralize our power and localize it. We need to diversify the energy source, geothermal, solar, could be almost everywhere. And then various places, wind, wave, algae, et cetera. Or the micro hydro, not big dams, because they emit a lot of methane, do a lot of damage, destroy the farming, increase climate change disasters that reduce our power ability. But small, as in your sewer systems, in your water systems. If we have lots of small solar, lots of small wind, lots of small hydro, and we have circulating geothermal that we don't remove the water, we just circulate it up, heat it, and put it back down again. If we stop fracking, stop drilling for oil, stop mining for coal, and stop messing up our coasts and our ocean currents, we will have reliable energy. And if it is democratically governed, regulated, and owned, we will be not wasting all that time, money, energy, and increased danger from high power, long distance transmission lines. We will not be as vulnerable to terrorist attacks. When California was planning on possibly having more regulation and public power, Pacific Power and Light, Pacific Core, sent down my father and others to Pacific Power and Pacific Gas Electric to send rolling blackouts and brownouts through California, to in effect extort people into paying more money by killing those who are poor and hospitals that were going to have patients die as a result. So what we can do is remove nuclear power, but once we have it, we need to constantly maintain the power supply so that we can have the cooling rods kept cool, so we can have the alarm system, so that we can keep enforcing the concrete cracks, that we could stop having planned releases, as in the Columbia Cascade generating plant just north of the Columbia River, that is intentionally releasing radiation. We're not even talking about accidental leaks.
Edie, can I just head you off just gently? You've given us a large array of things to chew on there. Before I turn it over to Mitch, you can stay on the line if you have something to rejoin her, but we only have one line open, I should remind people, because of me and my guest being on the phone lines and the phone line system at KBOO being what it is. I just want to add one thing, Edie, that I think you didn't mention. I think we sort of almost, I don't want to say we've given up talking about, but, you know, with the vast, the easy energy based on the whole electrification and the use of especially oil and then gas, sort of just led to this massive production and consumption boom, you know, post-World War II. And I think basically the whole system works together such that, you know, they encourage more consumption because it's so easy and relatively cheap, so that people buy more gadgets, and then there's things are built so that they don't last. So throwaway culture, this whole thing that we just sort of like so inundated with, and just so it's so massive that it's like, how do we even address it? But it's like, that's the thing that, you know, we could do all the things you're talking about so much easier if we just stopped wasting and consuming and producing so much stuff. I know that's another huge chunk, but I'll just turn it over to Mitch to riff on whatever you want to.
Well, getting to some of what Edie was saying, you know, we definitely need to have more distributed energy in this country. We should be moving rapidly towards new building standards that not only have highly energy efficient buildings, but wherever and whenever possible, those buildings should have solar panels on the roof, or if it's an office building in the parking lot, whatever, you know, actually works for the design. We do need to have more distributed energy. You know, microgrids can provide resilience in the sort of storms other instances that that happen. You know, we at Food and Water Watch advocate for a mix between, you know, more distributed energy and utility scale solar and wind, because you're going to have both to be able to power the country completely. But we do definitely need to get more distributed energy, not just solar, you know, geothermal heating systems, heat pumps, those sorts of things, to reduce our reliance on utility scale electric production. You know, and the idea of putting the hydro in the water pipes is a great idea. I've seen it, you know, demonstrated before. And given, you know, the fact that basically every major city in America needs to replace its water pipes, it does provide a great opportunity for doing that kind of localized hydro, adding a publicly owned, publicly controlled electric source while also improving the water infrastructure. You know, one issue that we haven't touched on, and, you know, we've not really directly, you would think, linked to all of this, is also there's a real role to play in the climate change, which is at the root of a lot of these problems. Is, you know, we also need to reform the ag system. As I said, we at Food and Water Watch, that's one of our primary missions, is to reform our food and agricultural system. I know Oregon has a lot of mega dairies. There's an ongoing campaign there that we're working on with local groups on the ground and activists on the ground to put a moratorium on new mega dairies in Oregon, because again, these are a major source of not only localized air and water pollution, but also of methane, which is an extremely powerful greenhouse gas. And so it's been interesting to me as we've been talking this morning, Paul, that you keep saying, oh, we're going, you know, far afield, or we're going bigger, but really it's kind of hard not to when we're talking about an existential threat to the planet, right? It's the throwaway culture. It's the for-profit, you know, the handing over of public goods to for-profit companies. It's the food system. Just across the board, we need major systemic change, not only in this country, but around the world, to fight all of these problems, because they all get tied back together again, especially when we look at that through the overarching lens of the climate crisis that we're experiencing.
What's up? Are you still with us, Edie? Oh, she left. I figured she would. Looks like we might have another caller. Elliot, well, let's just go right to Elliot before we launch into another discussion along those lines. Elliot, go ahead. What do you got to say?
Well, in his new book, Bill Gates, you know, made one interesting point to which, you know, there may already be an intermediate term solution. I mean, he pointed out that if you needed to use batteries with either a large ship or a large airliner, you know, 80% of the space would have to be taken up with batteries, and, you know, it's not yet a viable solution. But there's this guy, I don't remember his name, who had a proposal for putting wind power in the deep ocean, you know, where currently all we have is like plastic debris continents. Similarly, you could imagine putting solar fields, floating solar fields, out in the deep ocean. And then you immediately, in terms of the discussion today with the power grid and getting a new, you know, fourth generation power grid, you can't possibly, even with superconducting, high-temperature superconducting lines, you couldn't get it from the deep ocean to Kansas or even Portland. But you could solve, possibly, with some technical advances. I'd like you to discuss, maybe you can kill two birds with one stone, because out in the ocean, what do you have? An unlimited, infinite supply? Water. And what can you do with water? Well, at least two things. You can use the hydrolysis that is always demonstrated in junior high chemistry class to generate hydrogen. And if you had super tankers, instead of carrying the oil that's destroying us, if you had them carrying compressed hydrogen, you would have one fuel for transportation, and which happens actually to be a light fuel. And secondly, you also have an unlimited supply that they've known, discussed since World War II, of deuterium, of the heavy hydrogen that can be used as a fuel for fusion power.
Okay, we're getting way into some semi-futuristic things here, but they could. I certainly am not capable of evaluating. My personal preference is for deindustrialization as the solution, which I know is as quixotic as perhaps some of these big technological solutions, but I don't want to diminish it. Maybe, Mitch, maybe you've heard about these things that Elliot was talking about.
Well, there is a major effort to develop hydrogen at scale as a fuel source. There are some problems with how that's taking place, though. There are different types of ways to develop hydrogen. The most frequent one currently actually relies on fossil fuels and on fossil fuel energy to power it. But there are efforts to move towards what's known as green hydrogen, which is created through water electrolysis using renewable energy. The problem there is that frequently the people who are promoting the green hydrogen are doing so because they want to mix it with natural gas, fracked gas, in pipelines. And it's a way of prolonging, in some respects, the use of fossil fuels in our energy systems by giving them a little bit of a green wash with green hydrogen. But, you know, green hydrogen could play a role in the energy mix going forward, either as a fuel source, as the caller was suggesting, or as a form of storage, although my understanding based on experts at Cornell University is that it's maybe not the most efficient way to store energy. But there are roles being played, but we need to be vigilant and make sure that the hydrogen is being developed in the right way and being used for the right purposes. And right now, as we speak, the vast majority of the hydrogen is not being produced in the right way, and the green hydrogen is mainly being used to greenwash the continued use of fracked gas.
You're right about the status quo. I'm talking about, you know, being forced to move to the future.
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
well, thank you.
I understand that. Yep.
Thanks, Elliot. We only have a little over 5 minutes left. 503-231-8187. Maybe we can squeeze one last caller in. So, now that we've gone down this route, I mean, my tendency, you know, I mean, there's not much we can do about Texas. I mean, you talked about this Water Act that is going to be introduced. You know, we can certainly, you know, support legislation. You know, the Green Energy Fund that's very far sighted that Portland passed to encourage both sort of reparations for communities of color and encouragement of local projects for renewable energy is a great idea. You know, the whole recycling system, the whole issue of plastics, these are huge issues. But I just want to get back to the whole decentralization of energy. I heard about a whole new this is the kind of technology that actually could excite me. it's a whole new kind of small-scale wind turbine that is being that's being developed in Europe. Now, that's the kind of thing where, I mean, we should, you know, we need a massive redeployment. I think that that's probably what the Green New Deal, part of the Green New Deal, in addition to, you know, changing the grid, moving towards more wind energy, you know, all sorts of things. But things like that, you know, we need to redeploy the scientific skill and development and technical that's locked up by our major corporations, you know. So we need to unlock that and redirect it into things like some micro hydropower and small scale wind. Have you heard about this new generation of wind turbines that can, you know, you can put on your rooftop, for example?
Yeah, you know, Paul, I've heard of them, but I'm going to, I'll just be honest with you, I haven't done much research on it, but I am familiar with the fact that you can actually do distributed wind. It's obviously nowhere near as prevalent as distributed solar, but that is, you know, a real possibility and technology that is being improved upon. You know, we shouldn't be surprised. I grew up in Illinois, and my grandfather was a farmer, and he had distributed wind on his farm, right? Because he had a windmill for the water pumps. So, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that this sort of technology can be created, and it really could play a role, especially in areas where there is a lot of wind and maybe not as much solar, to have distributed wind. Either in addition to or instead of rooftop solar panels.
Well, I want to get to maybe to the final thing. We haven't really gone down the road too much of what we sort of have been alluding to a lot, which is the private corporate control of all these things and how we can move in that direction. Maybe Robbie, who's our last caller, I'd like you to keep it to maybe 30 seconds because we only have like a few minutes left, Robbie. But maybe you want to touch on that or something else briefly?
Yeah, actually, I've been following the energy thing very closely. I wrote my first book about an alternative energy form which uses magnets to separate hydrogen bonds, which right now there's, I mean, as you just said, all the patents for it are locked up. My uncles used to work at the GM Ford Motor plant. I had a lot of family that worked in the Michigan, Ohio area. They worked in these car plants. One of them was an engineer. They were telling my family back in, you know, when they worked there in the 70s, in the mid 70s, that they had blueprints for fuel injectors, which got close to 50, 70 miles a gallon. And they're just locked up. They're patented. They're put away. They're shelved. They're not doing anything. What they're doing is this hybrid. It's this hybrid technology, which is more complicated, creates more problems. And what they're doing is it's through the ways that they're regulating it right now. It's like, oh, this engine has to. They have the most ridiculous things in our cars where your car will turn itself off while you're at a stop.
Okay, Rob. Just to say, you're off there. You'll have another opportunity, another show, I'm sure. But we only have a couple minutes left. I want to give the last word to Mitch. But yeah, what do you see as the, you know, the main thing going forward? Is it the, you know, resting control from these private corporations who only have their private profits in mind?
Yeah, Paul, I do believe that is the thing that's going to be able to allow us to make the fair and just transition to renewable energy that we need to make in order to stop the worsening effects of the climate crisis. We need to wrest control of the fossil fuel industry and of our electric utilities from private for-profit companies so that they can be managed democratically for the benefit of the people and for the survival of the planet. You know, this is a really important component of this, which doesn't get as much airing as the technological approaches, you know, but the fact of the matter is that while we should be developing new sources of renewable energy, truly renewable energy going forward, we can make this transition now. We have the technology to make the transition now. What we need is our politicians to have our interests at stake and to pass the policies that we need in order to be able to transition off of fossil fuels and onto a 100% renewable energy economy.
And one last pitch for this Water Act that you, the scoop you gave us early on?
Sure. So the Water Act, again, is being introduced tomorrow, and I just double-checked. Neither Earl Blumenauer nor Susan Bonamici are currently on it, so if you're in those districts, give them a call and tell them to co-sponsor it. It's not too late. It will fully fund our water and wastewater utilities across the country and go a long way to fixing the water crisis that we face. And if folks want more information about it, you know, you can go to our website, which is foodandwaterwatch.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We covered a lot. Hope to talk to you again at some point. Mitch Jones with Food and Water Watch. Really appreciate you being with us.
I appreciate it, and I had a good time, Paul. Thank you.
Okay, great. And that's all for Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. Ciao, ciao.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Join KBOO Radio on Wednesday, February 24th, 2021 at 6:30 p.m. for a special program, BAM, Chicago's Black Arts Movement. Participants will receive an exclusive link to view the film.